You are listening to Radio Albion.
This is the Orthodox Nationalist. I am Matthew Raphael Johnson. And today's date is, believe it or not, the 4th of October, 2025. And I am very, I'm very pleased with the subject I'm dealing with today. I'm dealing with one of the great men, not just of nationalist history, of Orthodox history, but of human history. And the fact that very few people know who he is, well, is typical for our era. And that man is Nicolae Popescu, who died in 1931. You don't come across a guy like him all the time. His career was mostly as a physician, a doctor. He became globally famous for the discovery of insulin. And he was the first to discover it. But due to his politics, the honor of being the discoverer of that was given to others. Although there have been efforts to rectify this injustice, even the Nobel Committee admitted their error. But given the chaos of interwar Romania, this is really what we're talking about here, he never separated his medical practice from his politics, because he saw Romania as a patient and a sick one. Despite the fact that Romania grew very much after World War I, that just multiplied the problem. His most famous and most important book was written in 1913. Philosophic Physiology, The Hospital, The Quran, The Talmud, The Kahal, and Freemasonry. This is something that Codriano and the early generation of the Iron Guard all knew very well. And they revered this man. And it's a key summary of the connection that he makes between his life as a doctor on the one hand and his attempts to cure Romania at a political and spiritual level on the other hand. So what are the pathogens? What's the cure? Well, we know. The pathogens were liberalism and Marxism, both promoted by the world's Jews, who in Romania dominated key elements of the economy during the Depression and even before then. Keep in mind that you had many remnants of the former Islamic colonial apparatus still around, so he doesn't ignore the Muslims, especially the Sunni variety. The cure was Orthodox National Socialism. There's no question that he was the early proto-founder of the Iron Guard, and Codriano, as I said, knew his work very well. Popescu was a credit not just to Romania, but to Orthodoxy, even humanity as a whole. He was able to see what others could not, and that's what caused him to be punished accordingly. He was genuinely a great man. And we've dealt with many great men, great nationalists of various types over the years on the Orthodox Nationalist, all over the place, all different races, all different backgrounds. But Popescu was special, and we're going to see exactly why. But first, we need to get to some of the background here. Not everyone is fully cognizant of interwar Romania. So let's start there. It's true that because of the Treaty of Trianon, 1920, Hungary lost like almost 80% of its territory, mostly to Romania. So it was mostly doubled. Romania grew tremendously. You got the Banat from Hungary, Bukovina from Austria, Bessarabia from Russia. It was more or less the Greater Romania that emerged in 1920. And Romania, we talked about, you know, Bulgaria as a major power. At this point, Romania was considering itself a major power. In 1922, Ferdinand and Marie were crowned king and queen of Greater Romania and Transylvania. But Article 1 of the new constitution in 1923 declared Romania a unified, indivisible national state, and all that that implies. Now, Romania between the wars showed, like so many other European countries, the fraud of liberal democracy and monopoly capitalism. Immediately after the war, the dominant party in Romania was the National Liberal Party. But it was being forced to become more nationalist as time went on. Eventually, it was removed electorally by the National Peasants Party. But the problem was, as was the case everywhere in Europe, there was no stability. Between 1930 and 1940, there were over 25 separate governments in Romania. That was actually going on before, too. The fact that they had this massive Soviet empire and Romania was an oil producer, well, this actually mattered. But this chaos gave rise to another great man, Corneliu Codrianu, who read the works of Popescu and understood their meaning extremely well. Christopher Thorpe wrote an excellent summary of the issue way back in 2012. Let me read it from here. I don't know if we're going to actually, this may be a two-parter, but. However, in 1923, the Romanian government, under pressure from influential Jews in Romania, as well as abroad, decided to change the Romanian constitution to allow almost all Jews to become Romanian citizens. This allowed an alien body in Romania, languages, different religion, customs, racial type, and soul, to further infiltrate Romanian society and undoubtedly Judaize its culture. Romanian nationalists were shocked, and Codrianu was shocked so much that he cried. He explained the situation, and for my legionnaires, Codrianu reflects on how the great and highly respected Romanian leaders in 1879, after Romania won its independence from the Ottoman Turks, took action to make sure that Jews would not gain power in Romania. Even though they were forced to give Jews a theoretical right to citizenship, however, that right depended on qualification through military service, thus making only a handful of Jews citizens, since most Jews did not want to fight a war. I'm very pleased to be looking up at an icon of Codrianu right in front of me here at my desk. Again, the chaos creates these great men. But this didn't happen in a vacuum, though. Liviu Maniu, leader of the National Peasants Party, let me start this way. King Ferdinand died in 1927. And it's unfortunate because his son was Prince Carol, who became King Carol II. Now, he had renounced his right to the throne, and he was living 3 years in exile. His brother Nicolae was serving as regent, and his young son Michael as king. Carol changed his mind, and with the support of the ruling National Peasants Party, he returned and proclaimed himself king. That's what didn't happen in a vacuum. The National Peasants Party engineered this, but it was based on the promise that he would forsake his mistress, the vile Magda Lupescu. She was a Jew. Her maiden name was Grunberg. She had several names before then. And in fact, even Lupescu herself had agreed to this arrangement. But pretty much everything with Carol, it was based on deceit, and he reneged on it immediately upon taking power. And he began to arrange for her return. Monarchy of Carol II returned unopposed to Romania in 1930. Essentially, it was a coup. His earlier renunciation was declared invalid in parliament by a majority, and he was proclaimed king shortly afterwards. Now, why he brought this hideous Lupescu back, I mean, you should see her. I'm not sure why. But from that point on, she was in all but name his wife, and most certainly the senior partner in his political enterprises. Now, he reigned from 1930 to 1940. Corruption and intrigue in Romania rose to almost, you know, heights that Stephen King couldn't have written about. But given the fact that Jews dominated commerce and banking, well, it wasn't difficult to connect the dots. Now the king had taken a concubine of the same tribe. It was an outrage. Carol and Magda became the manipulators of Romanian politics. Everything was done based on deceit, or if they couldn't bribe someone or deceive somebody, they would simply eliminate somebody. And in the process, they became multimillionaires. A tremendous fortune did they amass. The Jewish Lupescu was the power behind the throne. But I'm not saying that Carol wasn't corrupt anyway. His personal corruption existed long before. Lupescu didn't enjoy official status really until 1938. Never accompanied the king on state functions, but that's not relevant to her power. She entertained at her villa in downtown Bucharest the elite of Romanian society. Everyone, industrialists, the press, aristocrats. However disagreements they may have had, they agreed on one thing. That one man had to go. The one threat everyone in that ruling clique believed had to go was Quadriano. And they had him murdered in 1938. Her unpopularity was very much albatross around the neck, or a millstone around Carol's neck for the rest of his reign. She was his closest advisor and confidant. She wasn't attractive, so there was something else going on. I can't help but be reminded of Ceausescu and Elena. I think Ceausescu would have been much more popular if Elena wasn't around. And the opposition to Carol II grew tremendously. But the worst part about a king this blatantly corrupt and Judaized is that it destroyed support for the monarchy in general that most Romanians had. His actions were outrageous. However, Quadriano was very clear. You could be a firm monarchist, as I am, but still reject these two. They're a mockery of monarchy everywhere. Oh, and by the way, they were married in a hotel room in Rio de Janeiro. And I think it was on June 6, 1947. She finally died in 1977 in Portugal, outliving Carol by almost 25 years. I don't know what she did in the meantime, but I know that she was living on the, which she was able to steal from the working man in Romania. You can't talk about this era, of course, without talking about the economy. And things like the Iron Guard don't make any sense. But the Depression mattered. The early 1930s, you had unrest, high unemployment, strikes. The Romanian government many times violently repressed them. The miner strike in 1929. Gravita, a railroad workshop strike. But there was some recovery, and part of it was because the Germans, under Adolf Hitler, became the central economic focus of Europe. If you connected yourself to them, you're going to do okay. Now, Romania was industrializing quickly. 80% of Romanians were still working in agriculture, but the industry was owned by foreigners, especially the French. And that influence was very powerful in the early 1920s. Germany became more dominant later on in the 1930s. And German National Socialism built a successful economy while the rest of the world seemed to be dying. And people noticed that fact. However, Romania did suffer a tremendous debt. There was a tremendous imbalance here. Now we deal with debts. You know, countries in debt 200% of their GDP. It's not a big deal. They weren't even close to that, and they were considered drowning in debt. But the economy of the matter is significant. Remember, its successes came from National Socialist Germany. Prior to that, the early years of the Depression, even before, Romania was extremely unstable. The Constitution of 1923 gave the Romanian monarch free rein. He could do as he pleased. He could dissolve parliament and call elections at will. Remember I said the governments between 1930 and 1940? Well, from 1933, there were another 25 governments. But that was happening all the time. And that was happening in many other countries, too. The National Liberal Party steadily became more nationalist than liberal, but it lost its dominance over Romanian politics. The National Peasants Party did grow in power, and one of its offshoots was the National Christian Defense League and the Iron Guard from that. The LANC merged with the National Agrarian Party to form the National Christian Party, and the Iron Guard was a earlier LANC offshoot. And they realized the danger of Marxism and the rule of Jews over Romania's economy, and the fact that the king was married to one was something utterly intolerable. 1933, the liberal prime minister, Ion Duca, dissolved the Iron Guard, arresting thousands of them. 19 days later, he was murdered by Iron Guard legionnaires in retaliation. And this went back and forth. But in 1937, the king appointed the National Christian Party leader, Octavian Goga, as prime minister of Romania's first truly national government. Carol actually met with Hitler, who allegedly expressed his will to see a Romanian government headed by the Iron Guard. February 10th, 1938, Goga insulted Lupescu. I think he did that all the time, but he used that to dismiss his government and institute a very short-lived royal dictatorship. 17 days later, there was a new constitution, which gave the king even more power. As I mentioned, April 1938, Carol had the Iron Guard leader arrested and imprisoned. On the night of November 30th, 1938, Codriano and several other legionnaires were killed while purportedly trying to escape from prison. Of course, they were doing no such thing. They were murdered because they were both popular and a threat to the pro-Allied crown, and the complete dismantling of Romania from within. The royal dictatorship was brief. We're a bit ahead of ourselves here, but March 7th, 1939, a new government was formed with Armand Călinescu as prime minister. September 21st, 1939, with 3 weeks after the start of World War II, Călinescu was assassinated by legionnaires, avenging Codrianu's murder. That was the same year that Germany and the USSR signed the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, which took Bessarabia from Romania. And Carol just had to deal with it. So he abdicated. And in his place was General Ion Antonescu, functioning as the new prime minister with full powers and ruling the state by royal decree. Now, we're going to go back and forth here, the context to the content, etc. But let's go back to our topic. Without the work of Nicolae Popescu, our world would be in a much more miserable place, especially when it comes to diabetes, a very modern disease. He did discover insulin. He was the first among everyone. He called it pancreatin, I think. 1916, Popescu developed a liquid pancreatic extract, which was able to normalize blood sugar levels in diabetic dogs. I have one of those. Now, he was drafted. I can't even believe you were a drafted guy like him. But we did go to World War I, probably not on the front or anything. But when he got back, in 1921, he wrote a lengthy paper research on the role of the pancreas in food assimilation. And that was, you know, the paper at the time. Came out in 21 in the International Archives of Physiology. Now, it was patented April 10th, 1922, by the Romanian Industry and Ministry of Industry and Trade, patent number 6254. So there's no question he did create insulin. I'm sorry, he was the first discoverer of insulin. He was able to isolate it. 1923, two others were recognized as creators of insulin. Frederick Grant Banting and the biochemist John McLeod. There was no question that Popescu's politics had something to do with it. But in 1921, Banting was doing the same experiments that led to the discovery of insulin on dogs. Inspired by Oskar Mikanowski from Poland, who in 1889 removed the pancreas from a healthy dog to test its role in digestion. So as far as those who were claiming to have discovered insulin, Popescu was successfully performing the same type of experiments in 1916. By the time Banting isolated the insulin, Popescu already held the patent for its discovery. Banting was clearly familiar with Popescu's work. He even uses his paper, Research on the Role of the Pancreas in Food Assimilation and Digestion, as reference in the paper that brought him the Nobel Prize. He does misquote it, however. The line that was he claimed was mistranslated was, he states that injections into peripheral veins produce no effect, and his experiments show that the second injections do not produce such marked effects as the first. That is not what he said. And Banting blamed the translator for it, who was done in Romanian, of course. He apologized for it and all the rest of it. These were Canadians, and they simply used Popescu's work for their own benefit. The statement I just quoted, misstatement, was a falsehood, and it made him look bad. The Nobel Committee, back in 1923, didn't really do their research, and other men received the prize for its discovery and not Popescu. It's true, you have a lot of people today, like Ian Murray in the 70s, promoting the international recognition of Popescu. Even people on the Nobel Committee. There was a team in Toronto that was, that really stole the honors from him. You even have a few Jews who say, well, you have to separate his politics from his science. We're going to discover here pretty soon. He refuses to do that. Popescu actually sees the two as one. In general, Popescu's experiments from 1916 are ignored. He's not even mentioned. If you go to Banting's biographical site, he's not even mentioned, not even as a precursor. I have an idea as to why. Codriano was a great man as well, not quite in the same way as Popescu. But just like in most of the countries of Europe, everything was falling apart. After World War I, World War I created so much PTSD. And then the Depression, the Soviet threat, everything else. Codriano went to Iasi, which was one of the Jewish centers of Romania at the time. About 40% of its population was Jewish, which meant that it was the communist center of Romania. The textbooks will tell you that Romanian workers at the time had poor working conditions and low wages, and therefore they were drawn to communism. Well, there's a bit more to that. The students at the university were, completely communist. Had communist student meetings. They went after the army, the church, everything else, the crown. Although the crown deserved it, but the crown in general. Anything that was against Romania. But Codriano discovered something. He he discovered something like the people listening to me have discovered something, like I discovered something. The leaders, in his case, of the Romanian Communist Party were not Romanians and were not workers. They had no connection to workers. At IASI, the workers' movement was led by a Dr. Gelerter, along with Gelier, Spiegler, Schreiber, the big three. The capital, Bucharest, the leaders were the infamous Anna Pauker and Ilya Moscovici. All of them, of course, were Jewish. And he saw the same thing in Russia, where a largely Jewish-led Bolshevik revolution occurred just a few years earlier, and Romania was in their crosshairs. And here's what he said in For My Legionnaires. If these communists have been victorious, would we have at least Romania led by a Romanian workers' regime? Would the Romanian workers have become masters of the country? No. The next day, we would have become the slaves of the dirtiest tyranny, the Talmudic Jewish tyranny. Greater Romania, after less than a second of existence, would have collapsed. We know how clearly this occurred around the same time in Hungary, with an almost exclusively Jewish government. There was one person in the entire governmental apparatus who wasn't a Jew. But as Romania grew after World War I, there was pressure from the West, from the British especially, to make Jews equal citizens with everybody else. And that was simply injecting the pathogen into the body of the Romanian body politic. It was a huge shock, because when you have a country in dissolution, the most dominant power is going to be the most cohesive power. And they already had tremendous wealth. And it was Pulescu, as well as people like Vasile Conte, Costas Negri, Mihail Eminescu, were some of the early writers in Romanian nationalism at the time, who understood all this fact. But the larger Romanian parties ruling the government did not take any action here. You know, for us, it's like, you know, the order of the day. But for them, it was outrageous. How do you let this happen? And it was because he read Pulescu that he came to understand the connection between the health of a society and its connection with Jews and their ideology. Some of the violence that came out of the Iron Guard came from despair and depression. Anybody who understands what happened after World War I will understand the mentality. I'm not a combat veteran, although I have been divorced by an American woman, and I think that counts. And unfortunately, with his Codrianu and Ion Motta, they were going to assassinate top Romanian politicians, rabbis, whatever. This was in a fit of desperation. And here's what he said about it. We unanimously agreed the first and greatest culprits were the treacherous Romanians, for whom Judas silver pieces betrayed their people. The Jews are our enemies, and as such they hate, poison, and exterminate us. Romanian leaders who cross into their camp are worse than enemies. They're traitors. The first and fiercest punishment ought to fall first on the traitor and then on the enemy. If I had one bullet, I were faced with both an enemy and a traitor, I will let the traitor have it. Again, that's from my legionnaires. Well, 1932, Codrianu entered the Romanian National Assembly in Moldova, but the treatment of Iron Guard members just got worse and worse as time went on. 1933, as I mentioned, Ion Duca allegedly elected into power, and he was dedicated to exterminating the Iron Guard. And I question any election veracity at the time in that country. But Duco was one of the worst. He had tortured, terrorized, murdered many legionnaires, and simply banned it to keep it from participating in any kind of an election. He rounded up 18,000, roughly. Codriano was not one of them. But there was a small group that assassinated him in revenge, and then immediately turned themselves into the police. And I'm not sure why they did that, but following it, the tortures and assassinations of legionnaires by the government then just increased. The trials against him and these men were as fake as you can get. They were closed to the public. They were biased. Codriano was eventually sentenced to 10 years for not even so much for murder, but for sedition and treason. And it wouldn't have mattered anyway. Even General Argeșanu, who was a new leader in the Romanian government, a bit later, executed 252 legionaries, imprisoned thousands more. So they really couldn't function as an organization at all. But still, 1940, and we're getting a bit ahead of ourselves here, but 1940, the Iron Guard under Horia Sima tried to negotiate with King Carol II, this guy. But later that year, Antonescu would finally be appointed to in Carol's place. And you would have something like the National Legionary State jointly ruled by Sima and Antonescu, bringing Carol's sordid reign to an end. So the level of corruption and evil in Romania at the time was such that the Iron Guard thought that violence was the only way out. But as we know, it did nothing for them, as that sort of thing tends to do. The assassinations only went to only boomeranged on them, and they were tormented all the more. Okay. That being said, let's go back to the book we're talking about here. Philosophic Physiology, The Hospital, the Quran, Talmud, Kahal, and Freemasonry. What I'd like to do is summarize it fairly quickly here, and then a bit later on, analyze its pieces in detail. The book is, the very fact that it's called Philosophic Physiology, he's connecting his medical work with the political work, seeing both Islam, Masonry, and Judaism as the pathogens in Romanian society. And this book is so interesting that most people haven't heard of it. How is a hospital connected to, you know, the Quran, the Talmud, the Kahal? What's the connection between the hospital and an orthodoxy? Well, hospitals are an inspiration of Christian charity. They didn't exist largely before the church. He talks about Islam and Judaism. Of course, he has to talk about Islam. I think they're very similar religions. I think Islam is a deliberate outgrowth of Judaism, like Masonry. And both of them are characterized by a cruel desire for dominion, wealth on the one hand and political control on the other. However, he does see the Muslim Arabs as superior to the Jews because there was actual valor there in their state building. The Jews, however, could only function through cowardice, and by that he meant deceit. Popescu brought out the Talmud. And in 1913, this book had been known really only amongst a few specialists. It's unfortunate that you have activists who just, you know, they cut and paste the same group of lines from a website, and they put it in their own paper and say that it's, you know, I've discovered this. Popescu actually came up with quite a bit that never get discussed. But for him and for so many others, at the time, the Talmud was a shock. The Talmud uses usury, fraud, perjury to rob and ultimately enslave the Gentiles. Now, when he's talking about the Kahal, he doesn't mean it literally. By his day, the Kahal was largely gone. Not the literal organization, but the idea. It has to do with their cohesiveness. I even use it that way sometimes. The Kahal conceives of the Jewish nation as one based on the Talmudic dogma of a chosen people, a doctrine according to which the Jews must not merge with any other nations, because God has promised them to possess the wealth and to rule the world. And that's a quote from him. Almost all of his citations come from Jewish sources, usually the Talmud, but some others too. On Freemasonry, which is the final chapter of his book, he uses a few other authors, Drumont's work, but it's far more comprehensive. You know, he says ultimately the motivating force of Judaism in general is hatred. And that motivates their involvement in European intellectual and political history. And it's found in the Talmud. Its effects are manifest all over the place. But early on, even the early Jewish-sponsored heretical movements, like the Ebionites in the first century AD, all the way up to the Protestant Revolution, and right up to Freemasonry itself. Freemasonry, what's the goal? Well, they may tell you it's to rebuild the Temple of Solomon. If they tell you that. But that's just a symbol. It's a watchword. The Temple of Solomon is to dominate the globe. It's a symbolic idea only. Freemasonry's organization, Polesco points out that despite its claimed philanthropy, its secretive nature is an indication that it really should be brought under suspicion. And he says, quote, "And to think that no one wonders why this society is hidden when it has purposes as sublime as a search for the truth." He also uses a book, also from Frenchman, Paul Copin Albencel, The Masonic Drama, The Occult Power Against France, which came out in 1908, detailing the hierarchy within the Masonic organization. You know, the lower degrees not having no clue what the upper degrees are really talking about. That upper degrees are either Jews themselves or highly Judaized men. The bizarre rituals that mark a Mason's progress, and really only a handful really get to the upper levels, they're all marked by the same Talmudic hatred. Talmudic hatred and revenge for those responsible for the destruction of the First Temple. Among the various targets of the Mason's hatred, the chief are, as we all know, the Orthodox and the Catholics. Masonry always has subgroups just like everything else. Copin Albencel notes, and he quotes him directly, he says, "Examples of such tentacles are the free thinking movement, human and civil rights movements, education, houses or schools, studying clubs, library societies, conferences, popular universities, even unions." I don't know what that union, does he mean labor unions? I'm not sure. It doesn't matter. The point is made very clear. But during the French Revolution, which was deeply Masonic, the Jacobins was a subgroup coming out of the lodge. But the effects of that revolution were the emancipation of the Jews, which just meant the persecution of the Christians. The Catholics, in this case. And he does say the chief targets were the Jesuits, who they fear above all of the other Christian orders because, Catholic orders, because of their high level of intellectual acumen. A lot of people think that they dominate the planet. Well, these revolutionary movements feared the Jesuits, at least back then. Today, of course, it's a very different story. The monasteries of the Jesuits were attacked in Portugal, Spain, France, and Austria. A huge campaign coming out of the French Revolution. And they just created the myth that a Jesuit is, by definition, a scoundrel. Polescu makes it clear that the revolutionaries in the late 18th century, it was a what we call a bourgeois revolution. Some of them supported Napoleon, despite his ambitions. But then Freemasonry started to turn on Napoleon. He was becoming dangerous to them and worked to bring him down. Jews, however, benefited from this emancipation, and not just France, but several European states. And all that meant was the coming revolution, starting in 1848, imposing bourgeois capitalist liberalism as a major political movement that would eventually lead, as Marx would say, to the Socialist Republic. And that goal was almost achieved. The Paris Commune, 1871, where the Third Republic was established, and French society was henceforth marked by the separation of church and state. Paris Commune, we don't have time to get into it, but for the left, for the revolutionaries, this is almost a sacred entity. But the real aims of these Masonic bourgeois republics, of course, were to destroy the monarchy, to abolish the church, and certainly from the education of the public, and to convert everyone from whatever they are, to make all of them a proletarian, so that they could easily be made to serve the ambitions of Judah. Now, what do I mean by a proletarian? For Marx, a proletarian is somebody who at one point was a peasant, but who wanted to make more money, so he went to go find work in the cities in the new factories. And he usually went by himself. He very quickly became very alienated from his old self. He was surrounded by every kind of temptation you could imagine. His nation, his church, that was all, you know, starting to float away. But the only thing that he had to offer, really, was his body. Therefore, he offered his body to work for a wage. That's the only reason that Marxism ever concerned itself with the proletariat. It's not because they were worried about it, but because they were the most alienated group of people, at least I thought so, that had lost their ties with the countryside, that were no longer Christian, at least in their minds, that were involved, you know, in prostitution and gambling and everything else, and therefore they were in a unique position. Because they were just atoms in the void, they could very easily be manipulated by Jewish propaganda. That's why, and that is the only reason why, the proletariat was the focus of Karl Marx's work. He also cites Bernard Lazare, another one of these outrageous Jews at the time, Anti-Semitism, Its History and Its Causes, from 1894. And within the book, I don't even think he knows this, but he says things that cause anti-Semitism to happen. He doesn't understand it. Polescu relates it to the Kulturkampf that Bismarck conducted against the Roman Church from 1872 to 1878. He also connects it to the Masonic French Prime Minister Jules Ferry in 1882, mandating purely secular education in France. Jules Ferry, avid supporter of Darwin, he was also a supporter of colonial expansion abroad, which makes sense. In a speech in the Colonial Empire before the Chamber of Deputies, March 28, 1884, he said, "It is a right for the superior races because they have a duty. They have a duty to civilize the inferior races." In other words, this is what Darwinism created in the social world. Now, he put it as a duty, but of course, it has more to do with industry and domination than anything else. We had a right to do that. It's not a duty. They had a right to do it because they clearly had dominated. No different than, you know, Darwin's conception of a species. So Polescu claims that Jewish socialism works towards the dispossession of private property by a state that is itself Jewish in its composition and interests. And these are false socialists. They're make-believe socialist movements. They're crystallized in the work of Karl Marx. I've said that 1,000 times. You had all kinds of anti-capitalist movements long before and long after Marx that had nothing to do with Marxism. And the anarchists were connected with it, although they opposed Marx for a few things. But they were often used as a more murderous and iconoclastic elements in the street from 1848, 1871 onward. These are all the results of Jewish emancipation. Now, he makes the claim that Leon Gambetta was a Jew, and I don't know if that's true. Despite his name, he was French, president of the Council of Ministers, 1881-1882, actually Ferry's successor, who says that clericalism is the enemy. Again, another Darwinist, mandating a secular education. Darwin was central to all of it, and of course a contempt for the church as a whole. The Latin language was deposed because it was the language of the church and medieval Europe. Ultimately, what they posited in front of a student was that all that exists is matter and energy. Therefore, the Masonic Marxist idea was that the soul doesn't exist, and the Trinity certainly does not. But what do you get when you start off with this, a rejection? We're talking about matter in the void or matter and energy. Well, Christ stresses love and charity. Charity has nothing to do, it has no place in a world of matter and energy alone. Drummond and so many of the Darwinists had a distinctive contempt for, hatred of poverty. Certain extreme Protestant sects coming out of Calvin thought the same. The Mathens thought the same. So, Bolescu is arguing that by obliterating the Christian doctrines of compassion and charity and enlarging the worldly possessions and power of the Jews, Freemasonry then has finally accomplished in the post-revolutionary Europe what the Talmud had started off to achieve in the very first centuries of the Christian era. Now, stop here. That's the basic summary of the book. Now, a lot of that stuff seems pretty normal to our educated listeners. But at the time, it was not normal at all. It was revolutionary to hear this stuff. By Freemasonry, I'm not sure that he necessarily means just a specific group of lodges. Because most of the enemies of the church had a cellular structure, whether political or otherwise. They may or may not have had degrees. Many of them did. And as time went on, they increased those degrees. You know, Aleister Crowley had into the hundreds, you know. And even in terms of the Talmud, the book didn't do anything. But the mentality that it created. And the Freemasonry for the Gentiles and the Talmud for the Jews was a huge, overwhelming enemy for the church, or at least it seemed at the time. So now let's get started with, okay, I've been on 50 minutes already. Well, that's how, so it's going to be a two-parter, I think. I'm not sure yet. Now let's get into the content of Bolescu's book in great detail. And I think this is absolutely worth it. He starts off asking what a doctor is, what a physician is. It's someone who practices medicine. But that just begs the question, what the heck is medicine? Medicine is both a science and a profession. As a science, medicine studies man and studies him as a whole, body and soul, from a morphological, physiological, and pathological point of view. He lists three things: the shape of the human body and the organs that constitute it, anatomy, of course, the intimate structure of these organs, histology, the evolution and reproduction of the individual, you know, embryology, obstetrics, whatever. Number two, the vital phenomena of nutrition and relationships, physiology. And three, general diseases, organ disorders that disrupt vital phenomena of nutrition and relationships. In other words, relationships among the organs, nosology and pathology. So, medicine studies man, and alone among the sciences, has man as its sole object of study, physically speaking. It is a science with practical implications, or applications, and it starts off only with positive facts. It doesn't follow systems, doesn't follow utopias. It starts off with an imperfect knowledge of man, and wants to fill in those gaps. Medicine truly knows man. Now, he does say beyond the physical, medicine is involved in man as a whole. But he stresses mostly the physical side of things. As a profession, medicine serves man in two ways. Through hygiene, in other words, protecting someone from disease, as a shield from disease. And, of course, secondly, through therapy, which is once you have a disease, relieves his pain and seeks to cure him, or at least avoid his death. That's what medicine does. Now, that implies the life of a doctor is a difficult one. It's a life that devotes himself to those who suffer and often risks his own life to save that of others. You may get what they have. There is a tremendous asceticism in his mind to the medical profession. We see this in the Black Death, where so many of the clergy were destroyed because they were the first people who, you know, worked on the sick. They got it and died. It's an ascetic discipline. And what other profession, he says, so do you have this self-sacrifice that medicine imposes on its practitioners? So of all professions, medicine is the most important, or the most beneficent, at least as far as our physical well-being is concerned. But the doctor, through his profession, almost by definition, becomes the friend and even the confidant of those who suffer, rich or poor, young or old. Listen to him and obey his prescriptions. A doctor should know the instincts and therefore the passions. It's easy for him, by word and example, to enlighten humanity and guide its social education, combating these passions, to spread the principles of true scientific morality. Thus, the father of medicine, Hippocrates, was right to say, quote, "The ultimate goal of medicine is not only to cure and prevent diseases, but also to perfect people and make them happier, making them better." That also implies that a doctor must therefore be, at the same time, a scholar who loves medical science, the science of man, a being who sacrifices himself for others, even to death. And finally, to be a teacher of humanity, an apostle of morality in the world. Now, clearly, you see where he might be going here. He's not just a doctor in terms of diabetes. He's also looking at Romania as a whole, as a diabetic patient. So what does it mean to be sick? The patient is an individual in whose body, under the influence of a pathogenic cause, disorders of vital nutritional and relational functions have occurred. Disorders that may threaten his existence. That's his definition. There are sick people who are poor, they can't afford medical care, and because of it, they can't earn the necessities of life. Such sick people, who would perish if abandoned, come to the hospital. Such conditions, for example, there's a carpenter who, falling from a scaffold, broke an arm or a leg, a peasant who struck by pellagra, lost his mind, a city dweller, struck down by typhus, lies unconscious for 3 weeks. Alongside the worker who has fallen from the scaffold and victim of work, alongside the peasant and the city dweller, often victims of a defective social organization, you'll meet this in the hospital. People like this in the hospital, and still in large numbers, victims of their own passions. That is to say, of instincts deviated from their true purpose. Individuals who inspire disgust and who seem to be unworthy of any interest. You'll meet, for example, the drunkard who, unwilling to curb his thirst for drink, throws into the hands of the tavern keeper everything he's earned, even the food of his children, who poisons the life of his wretched wife, dishonors his parents, the shame of the family, the scourge of society, and who ends in imbecility if the opiate, the just punishment of such a suicide, did not come to shorten such a degrading existence. You'll find a fornicator who, not understanding or mocking the importance of the genital instinct, whose purpose is reproduction, sees in it only a means of obtaining pleasant tickling and abuses the acts of generation until he becomes tabetic, which is a late-stage syphilis, or contracts diseases, which the people rightly call shameful. Now, there have been times that I have seen some of these people who have deliberately done things to themselves and then call on the hospital's limited resources to fix them. A doctor can't be worried about that. That's not the point. And that's where morality comes in. Now listen to this. He says, in the hospital, you'll discover people of other nations, Hungarians, Greeks, Jews, nations that are even enemies of ours, are waging a life or death struggle against us, some of them. Now all of these people, good or bad, virtuous or vicious, compatriots or enemies, receive the same care in the hospital, regardless of their merits or wretchedness. Why? Couldn't we destroy these sick people, at least get rid of the vicious ones? A burden to society? And those of another nation who are a danger to the Romanian nation? Well, there's a good reason for this. And sometimes I struggle with it. Ancient times in the Roman era, sick slaves who could no longer serve their masters were simply abandoned on an island somewhere. And they died of hunger. Darwinism gave new life to this idea. Not to spare the sick. They're considered fallen competitors. Only the strong survive, the healthy. Everyone else condemned to perish. Now this hideous law, contrary to what we think, does not exist in nature, but only in the crazy minds of a few materialist atheists. But you'll tell me, men like animals have an instinctive feeling of compassion, of pity for their fellow men who suffer. This feeling, intense for family members, weakens more and more for members of their tribe and nation, ends up being almost null for members of humanity. At that point, it's called philanthropy. In any case, mercy does not exist for the wicked, and especially for enemies. Therefore, the instinct of mercy cannot preside over the creation of hospitals. Now, what's his broader point here? It was hospitals only came into existence in the early Christian era. A hospital is a place where poor patients find free of charge medical care they need, as well as everything else they need to sustain life during their illness. They have to have the building that contains certain, interior conditions, ventilation, heating, whatever, suitable furniture, sufficient income to broadly meet the needs of their patients, and have a trained and devoted medical staff and nursing staff. Now, why is it fairly recent? There were no hospitals in ancient times. No public establishment, indeed, specifically and solely for the sick, ever existed in ancient Egypt. None among the Jews. And we see this in the New Testament. The sick and infirm were gathered to public squares, near pools, crossroads, under porticos, to receive mercy from passersby. Some of them even reached out to Christ. We know this. We have the same for the ancient peoples, the Medes, the Persians. In India, hospitals were unknown. In China, the same. And the cities of Greece, they did have things like gerousia, public buildings for the elderly. They had rendered service to the fatherland. They were maintained at the expense of the state. The Cynosargus was a place where abandoned children were gathered. The Xenodoches, open to all foreigners, received only healthy people, though. Nowhere, though, is there any mention of buildings specifically intended for the sick. Until the first century of the Christian era, the Romans, like the Greeks, had no hospitals. Later, the religion of Christ came to tell man that a suffering human being is a brother who must be comforted. Only then was it possible to create true hospitals. A hospital, therefore, is an inspiration and a creation of Christian charity. I think it's very clear. Spartans, mother gave birth. If there was something wrong with it, they tossed it. You absolutely see this in the animal kingdom many times. There's limited resources. What can we do? This is one of the things that the church came to destroy. And someone, it's very counterintuitive to me, especially to me. Especially when I see someone who has deliberately destroyed themselves, they go to the hospital and they demand to be cared for. I'm outraged by this. When someone comes up to you in the street and asks for money, you give it to them. I don't care what they're going to use it for. It's none of my business. That's not the point. Charity is of a total different order entirely. Christianity said that things like euthanasia and, you know, infanticide were out of the question for civilized people. Now, of course, it is, at least in Europe. We have abortion instead. But as early as the mid-3rd century, 4th century especially, you had these institutions that began to be built in both the West and the East, where the poor and infirm were housed and fed. But the first hospital for the sick was founded in Rome, roughly 380-381, by a pious Christian woman, Fabiola, whose good deeds have been transmitted to us through the writings of St. Jerome. Around the same time, in actually 372, St. Basil of Caesarea financed a very famous institution, the gates of his city where the sick were received and cared for, using the fairly advanced medicine of ancient Greece. They had a substantial, you know, longevity. You know, they had an advanced system of medical care. A lot of these things have been lost. St. Gregory of Nazianzus, he said, as soon as you leave the city, you see a new city, which is a sanctuary of piety. Their illness, endured without murmuring, seems to be a blessed trial. Their charity shines in its works. You know, he's talking about the hospital. Under Emperor Justinian and his successors, such places multiplied in the East. Towards the end of the 6th century, hospitals appeared in the West en masse. They initially were annexes of churches and monasteries, then as independent establishments. But prior to this, institutions that dealt solely with the sick, solely with burdens on society, whether it's their fault or not, did not exist. It didn't exist because the Christian concept of charity didn't exist. Now, I'm going to stop part one here of Popescu's conception of medicine and its connection to what he saw was a growing, but at the same time dying Romania. We'll get more to his conception of the Muslims and Jews at war with this concept, the concept of the hospital. The hospital is central to him. Now, of course, they had hospitals in the Islamic world. In ancient Judea, they did not. But we'll pick up from here next week. Thank you, everyone. Bye-bye.